When I last left Israel in June 1998, the director of military intelligence said that the most recent assessment put out by the Israelis was that Iraq was the number six threat and falling, and that's because they knew through the weapons inspection work that Iraq no longer possessed weapons of mass destruction, and as long as inspectors were in Iraq, could not reconstitute this. This is the status quo ante that existed internationally in 1998. What happened between 1998 and 2003 to change this? September 11th, ladies and gentlemen, September 11th. And at least the Bush administration is honest enough to say that. But it didn't change the facts. All September 11th reflects and is representative of is our collective ignorance as a people. Shame on us. Because from that ignorance comes fear. If you listen to George Tenet today, he spoke of intent. We know Saddam intended to acquire weapons of mass destruction. We know he intended to have a ballistic missile program. We knew no such thing. How can you know intent unless the man says it and Saddam's not confessing anything? There are no documents to show that he wanted weapons of mass destruction. It is purely speculative based on what? What I call the theocracy of evil. You see, we label Saddam Hussein evil. We live in a black and white world, a good versus evil world. And by calling Saddam evil, a couple things happen, ladies and gentlemen. A, the ends justify the means now. You see, Saddam's evil. He must be confronted. Evil must be eliminated. So things such as the democratic niceties no longer matter. We need to get rid of evil, so whatever we do to get rid of evil is justified, even lying to Congress and lying to the American people. The other thing that happens is because he's evil, everything about him becomes evil. An evil man must therefore intend to acquire weapons of mass destruction. We don't need to prove it. We assume it. And now that we assume he intends to acquire, every piece of data that passes our desk as CIA analysts is therefore interpreted based upon that assumption. The theocracy of evil is the undoing of American democracy because we can never tolerate a situation in which the rule of law established by the Constitution is overcome by the ends justify the means, because if it's good enough for Saddam, ladies and gentlemen, it's good enough for us, meaning that when the government starts to turn its attention on us, and one only needs to reflect on the Patriot Act to understand the real potential of this, the rule of law will not be there to protect us. Now, George Tenet said that there was no pressure on the president. It was just bad intelligence. And yet, the only time George Tenet gave out any specific data, he gave away his hand. You see, George Tenet spoke of the defection of Hussein Kamal, Saddam Hussein's son-in-law. In August 1995, underscore August, he said, without that defection, UN weapons inspectors would never have been able to uncover Iraq's biological weapons program. Hussein Kamal spilled the beans in August. With all due respect, Mr. Tenet, your chronology's off a little bit, because our investigations uncovered Iraq's biological weapons program in April 1995. We confronted the Iraqis, and they confessed. In July 1995, the Iraqis admitted to having an offensive biological weapons program. Hussein Kamal defected in August. You tell me how that adds up, Mr. Tenet, Mr. Director of the CIA. But there's other problems, too. Because I led the investigation into Hussein Kamal's defection. I know what he told the United Nations. I know what he told the CIA and British intelligence. It's the same. He said that there are no weapons of mass destruction left in Iraq. Everything has been destroyed. He said, I ordered it all destroyed, including the biological agent. Now, this is known to the CIA. This is documented. It's in black and white. And what George Tenet said today either is reflective of his ignorance of his own intelligence data, or it's an outright lie. But now we need to reflect on this. What he said mirrors exactly what Dick Cheney, the Vice President of the United States, said before the Veterans of Foreign War Convention in Nashville, Tennessee in August 2002. Now, Dick Cheney is the same Vice President that spent almost a dozen trips down, or took almost a dozen trips down to Langley to sit down with the CIA analyst saying, you need to give me some data that proves Saddam Hussein has weapons. Now, Dick Cheney is spouting lies in August 2002. The director of CIA is spouting the same lies today, and they're trying to tell us that there was no pressure put on the intelligence community. The president signs the authorization to go to war in Iraq in August of 2002. tells the CIA to prepare an estimate in September 2002 that is published in October 2002 that is used as the justification to go to war. It's not the intelligence that triggered the war. It's the policy that triggered the war. It's the policy that used the intelligence. It's the policy that abused the intelligence. Now, I'm somebody who believes in democracy, ladies and gentlemen, so much that I'm willing to die for it. But let's understand this. American democracy is founded in the Constitution of the United States of America and the ideals and values contained within. American democracy demands much of we the people. In fact, the preamble of the Constitution says just that. We the people of the United States in order to form a more perfect union. The Supreme Court of the United States says that that preamble in effect means that the Constitution belongs to the people, not to the President, not to Congress, not to anyone else. It's our document. So what are we going to do about it? If we have a situation where the President of the United States has lied, we have a situation where we the people, together with Congress, the media, and the executive branch, have fallen victim to the theocracy of evil, where we can be exploited through our ignorance to fear things enough that we allow the ends to justify the means, it means that we have given up on the Constitution. We have walked away from the Constitution. This is unacceptable. A couple things have to happen, ladies and gentlemen. We have to realize that we can blame the President all we want, we can blame Congress, we can blame the media, but we better be fair and look in the mirror and blame ourselves, because we're the ones who have failed here. We have failed our troops. We have failed ourselves. Reflect on this. Are you a citizen or are you a consumer? Have you wrapped yourself in a cocoon of comfort, and so long as the powers that be keep you waddling down a path of relative prosperity, you don't want to rock the boat. You'll believe anything that comes from the government. In the Democratic primaries, a couple things have jumped out. Here we are at war with Americans dying on a fraudulent basis. Our Constitution is under attack. Our democratic processes are under attack. And yet our number one concern is the economy, our jobs. Consumers, ladies and gentlemen, not citizens. Because if we're citizens, one thing would scream out loud. The President lied. What are we going to do about it? There is a concept in democracy, in the circle of democracy, that is called accountability. When we elect people to higher office to represent us, we must hold them accountable for what they do in our name. Now, we can say impeachment, but we also can say election. We got a date coming up in November of this year. President Bush is running for re-election. He has opponents who want to take his job from him. What are we the people going to do? And this is a black and white issue, ladies and gentlemen, because when we speak of national security, we don't just want to talk about what's happening outside the border, although that's important. I guarantee you this, on every level, the war on terror waged by President Bush has made this country even more at risk. We haven't won the war in Iraq. We haven't won the war in Afghanistan. We haven't won the war on terror. But we have created perpetual warfare. And perpetual warfare thereby raises the fear factor here in America, exploiting our ignorance, allowing the greatest assault on the security of the United States of America to transpire, and that is the assault on the Constitution, on the basic principles of law that is being done by the Patriot Act and being done every day in the name of homeland security. When we speak of Osama bin Laden, we speak of a threat to the United States. This may shock you, but I view George W. Bush as a greater threat to the United States than Osama bin Laden. Because Osama bin Laden is not assaulting the bedrock that defines who we are and what we are as a people. He attacks us physically. He kills us. He destroys our buildings. And yes, this is bad, but George W. Bush is destroying our soul, destroying our spirit, destroying who we are and what we are as a nation. This war in Iraq represents the manifestation of all the failures of Bush's policies, and I ask you, what are you going to do about it? The President of the United States has lied to you. He has got us involved in a war that is killing Americans. He has made a situation that has resulted in the total loss of honor and integrity for our nation. We are not viewed in the world anymore as a nation of honor. The president has done this. And if you want to retain your status as members of a representative democracy, what are you going to do about it? Thank you.
That was Scott Ritter, former United Nations weapons inspector. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201 CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. We'll conclude the program with selected questions addressed to Ritter and Mahajan by the West Hartford audience.
My question for both of you is there a way to have a people's tribunal to try the Bush administration, to cite the war crimes, to go over by list what has failed in this policy?
Well, first, I'd say that there is already a move afoot to have an international criminal tribunal, which is the model is it was started by a group of people in Istanbul. The model is in different countries they will have their own tribunals. Some countries will have associated events that are not. Each one of them will be some kind of people's tribunal. There is some planning going on for one in New York. And so I think that's all a good thing, and it's very important to document in detail all of the crimes going on. But let us remember that a people's tribunal, it can be important, it can mobilize people, it can get media attention, it can maybe, in some world we can try to imagine, get the attention of actual international legal institutions, but it is basically a symbolic thing. And we need to do symbolic actions, but we need to go beyond that now, too. We need to start thinking about how do we wrest power out of the hands of these people who are running it who are running the country right now, and more particularly, not just how do we get the Bush administration out, but how do we counteract these policies? How do we stop the occupation of Iraq, which is not going to end just because we get Bush out? We need to keep that in mind as well. We need to be thinking a lot bigger. We need people's tribunals. We need all kinds of educational things, but we need to be thinking bigger, and we need to be thinking about getting organized.
I would just add on that in my opinion, when you speak of going to a people's tribunal, it means you've given up on American democracy. The ultimate people's tribunal is the Congress of the United States, who are theoretically directly responsible to we the people. Why don't we hold them accountable, put them under pressure so they do the right thing by us? And you know what? They're the only tribunal that has the ability to impeach the President of the United States.
Next.
I have one comment and a question for both of you. My first comment is, in the summer of 2002, I picked up a book by Mr. Pitt that carried an extensive interview with Scott Ritter. And my rhetorical question is, I really don't understand why I seem to have more knowledge than most of Congress and most of the Senate about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq from purchasing a $9 book. So I'm really high on reading right now. My question, I'm hoping that both of you can maybe clear something up for a bunch of us. I want to ask you about depleted uranium. There's been a lot of what seems to be rumor and a lot of hard feelings and from a lot of people. And there's even an ex, I believe, Marine, a woman Marine, in the state of Maine who's waging a campaign and believes that it's very dangerous for the citizens of Iraq and for the U.S. Army. And I'm wondering if either of you know any facts and can comment on this, we would all appreciate it. Thank you.
And here you happen to be asking someone with a PhD in physics. What I'd say about depleted uranium is this. We know certain things for sure. We know there's something called Gulf War syndrome, and it's very debilitating. We know that in southern Iraq, there is strong anecdotal evidence of a dramatic increase in extreme birth defects, what they call teratology, sort of monster-like birth defects, and in leukemia. We know a few other things. There were a few cases of European soldiers who were involved in Kosovo getting leukemia as well. That's pretty much all of the hard evidence we have. We don't know. All of these things are multi-causal, right? The Gulf War soldiers got exposure to depleted uranium. They also got a whole cocktail of experimental vaccinations. They were also moving into an area where the United States bombed chemical factories. The United States bombed two operating nuclear reactors, if you can believe that. Never before in history has anyone bombed an operating nuclear reactor. Imagine what could have happened, right? So all of these things happen together, and we don't know how to disentangle all of the causes for them. There are strong reasons to believe that depleted uranium has limited effect. Its level of radioactivity is very, very low, all right? But there's questions because the kind of radioactivity that it sends out can be highly destructive if it's inside your body. So there's real questions about how much of it is retained in your body. If it's outside the body, it's not going to do much to you, but if it's ingested and retained for years, then it can do something. And it's a big, murky area, and there have been a couple of studies done by the World Health Organization. There's concerns that some of the results are covered up or deleted. And all you can say for sure is there's a need for a serious epidemiological study in Iraq, which has never been done, and there's a need for a serious study on what could be the possible pathways of causing these things, and the United States has not done it, and the United States, which chooses to use depleted uranium weapons in all of its wars, has an obligation to do that. The very least you have to do to make sure that your weapons are consistent with international law is study what effects they have. And of course, we know with cluster bombs, those are clear violations, and they still continue to use them. Here, we just don't know, and no one wants to find out.
Yeah, I would second this by noting that the World Health Organization did apply to the Security Council of the United Nations in the mid-1990s to carry out such a study in Iraq, and the United States vetoed it and wouldn't allow it to take place. At the same time, that an overwhelming body of medical data was emerging that suggested not only that Iraqi civilians and Kosovar civilians were being impacted by the effects of depleted uranium, but from my perspective, and again, I'm an unabashed pro-American person, the men and women who serve the United States of America are being impacted. I mean, we put our men in harm's way when they go into combat, then we use a weapon that haunts them, and not just them, but their children, the children of American veterans who have birth defects because of depleted uranium or potential depleted uranium exposure. This demands action. I think the United States, we the people, need to serve our forces better by insisting that our government, those whom we elect to higher office to represent us, carry out the studies necessary to determine whether or not depleted uranium is a health risk, and if it is a health risk, to immediately cease and desist in incorporating depleted uranium weapons into our arsenal, take care of our veterans, and take care of the innocent civilians globally whom we've infected with this horrible malaise.
Next. I'm Matt McLaughlin from the Hartford Independent Media Center. I'm curious about what both your thoughts would be on what you see for the future of Iraq, the conflict there, and its people, and the U.S. involvement there.
When I talk to Iraqis, there's a very wide variety of views. Remember, you know, Iraqis are people too, and like people anywhere else, they have many different viewpoints. And there were people who thought that that civil war would break out immediately if the United States left. There were people who said the United States should get out, there won't be any problem. The majority of people probably thought there would be civil war. Majority of people in the Sunni Triangle area would also tell you that everything the United States is doing is exacerbating the chances of a civil war once they pull out. And so they're actually probably deliberately increasing all the sectarian divides. The one thing that everyone in Baghdad will complain about is the strict confessional basis on which they created the governing council. It's not, are you an Iraqi or not? It's X number of seats for Shia Arabs, X for Sunni Arabs, Y for Kurds, and all of these things done very much on the basis of defining your identity as being Sunni, Shia, Arab, Kurd, Turkoman, whatever, all of these things, many of which were not really officially cataloged under Saddam's Iraq, where there was at least somewhat more of just a purely nationalistic feeling. For example, if you take a census data from Iraq, you can't tell if someone is Sunni or Shia. from the census data, just if they're Muslim or Christian. Now the United States is defining these things and exacerbating the tensions, and also there's a widespread perception among Sunni Arabs, which is somewhat true, not as true as they say, but is somewhat true that they're favoring Kurds and Shia. And so the United States is increasing all these tensions, increasing the chance of a civil war if they leave. At the same time, as I said, there's no reconstruction going on in a large part of the country. There's no government or possible governmental body being formed. There's just a sham process that has so far involved only parties that say they're willing to sign on to the U.S. occupation, and everything looks very bad. There are a couple of small, little kinds of efforts that are very hopeful. In particular, there's one that's being run out of Qadami, out of Baghdad, by a well-known Shia cleric who is trying to bring together parties, organizations, politicians in some kind of national conference with just two basic ideas. Everyone who's involved in it has to be not associated with Saddam's regime and not associated with the coalition provisional authorities regime. They have to be independent of both. They have to be against the occupation, but they can be Sunni, Shia, Arab, Kurd, in favor of an Islamic state, in favor of a secular state. They just come together on the basis of being against an occupation and wanting to build an independent government and an independent polity. And in Iraq, that definitely means an independent armed forces as well, because without that, they can't maintain order in the country. There are some hopeful signs like that. They're very small right now. If they get very much larger, they're going to be directly in conflict with the way the United States is running the occupation and will probably be repressed pretty severely. So it's something that people in the United States have to pay real attention to, because the repression of those nonviolent, independent organizing in Iraq can be severely mitigated if we shine a spotlight on it from here.
Now, what I would say is this. I fought very hard to keep our country out of this war in Iraq for a number of reasons. One, it was unjust. And two, I knew that once we got into it, there was not going to be any clean way of getting out of it. First of all, dispel yourselves of any illusion that there's some magic formula that's somehow going to make it all right. It will never be all right. Iraq is a disaster, and it's a disaster that grows every day. I think you would agree that the Iraqi people, once given the opportunity, will find a way to take care of themselves. They'll get rid of the garbage on the streets. They'll pave the streets. They'll get medicine to the hospital. They'll make their life livable. American troops in Iraq are not facilitating this. Furthermore, because I have a loyalty to American troops, I want the war memorial that will be built about the Iraq war to be as small as possible. We already have far too many names. One more name is not needed. Every American that dies in Iraq is a death that is futile in serving nothing. We cannot win this war. We need to figure out how to mitigate our defeat by getting our troops home now.
Yes. For roughly 30 years, we've truly enjoyed a luxury in this country, and that is an all-volunteer army. Because of the lies that have been perpetrated by this administration, would you envision that perhaps within the next 10 years, we will be forced to return to the draft?
As somebody who has only served in an all-volunteer army, I'm too young to have had any experience with the conscript army or the draft army, I have to tell you this. And again, I preface this by not speaking as a tough guy who's in praise of war. I hate war because I've seen war. But if you're going to go to war, you want to go to war with an all-volunteer professional military, because there's nothing on the face of the earth that can stand up to us. We will win every fight we enter into in a classic military confrontation. What's happening in Iraq is not a classic military confrontation. It's basically us being lined up as sitting ducks. So I would like to strive to maintain the all-volunteer army. The key concept to this is that the military is there for our self-defense, that we have a military so that people out there, A, will not want to attack us, and B, if they do, will suffer the quickest defeat possible. I don't want a conscript military because I lose efficiency. But when you look at the Bush administration's policies, we are two divisions short in the United States Army from meeting our strategic requirements for defense. Now, the Army has cheated with stop-loss measures that have kept 35,000 troops in service for a period of, I think, 90 days. When that ends, we now will be two divisions short. Congress is talking about the expense of rebuilding two divisions, and they're saying this is prohibitive. They can't afford it. Their only solution, therefore, is selective service. If George W. Bush is reelected President of the United States of America, I make the following prediction. By the second year of his second term, there will be selective service, and our young men and women will be going into the military, whether they want to or not, to serve his policies of global empire.
Let me not make an actual prediction, because every time I make predictions, the stumbling block for me is always assuming that the administration is going to be somewhat rational in looking after their own interests. And they have a fundamental problem right now. Rumsfeld and his whole gang have been going on this idea for many years now that the ultimate army is one with very few soldiers, highly technologized, where you have a single super soldier who is completely in contact with huge amounts of offensive weaponry and technology, so that one soldier in the idealized vision 20 or 30 years from now can control square miles of battlefield all by himself. That's what they're pushing towards, and then in the middle of this they decide, oh, let's go and occupy a country. It doesn't make any sense. It's completely against the vision of the military they've been putting forward, and so they have a fundamental contradiction, and it's hard to know how they can get out of it. They're doing little things. They're doing the stop-loss measures that Scott talked about. They passed the No Child Left Untouched by Military Recruiters law. Sometimes laughably known as No Child Left Behind. They're doing these things, but none of them are really enough to deal with the problem. And so that's why the question of the draft is even on the table. But I will say this. If they do that, that will be the mistake that ends them. Right? One of the central lessons they learned from the Vietnam War, don't have a drafty army. Otherwise, you can go to war, you can have people die, you can have the whole world breaking loose, and the American middle class, most of the time, just doesn't care. All right? They don't do very much. Even if they say they care, the most they do is come out to a town hall meeting. But you institute the draft, and that all changes. That changes dramatically. That means everybody has a material interest in making sure we don't go to war and making sure we get out of Iraq. That way that everybody cares about the 500 people dead, not just the people who are in military families and a few activists around them. And that way you also introduce into the army people who haven't been heavily indoctrinated in this kind of ideology of American supremacism, that all of them get indoctrinated into. So in every way, it's against their own interests politically to do it. It's against their long-term strategic interest to reinstitute the draft. They've put themselves in a bit of a bind, and it's not clear how they will do it. And again, I won't make any predictions, because there seems to be no insanity to which they will not rise given the opportunity.
Go. Hi, my name is Beth Angel. I'm just a citizen, unemployed, because my work has gone overseas. I'd like to get some comments on a couple of reports. First, a report that the secret meetings Cheney's had behind doors to force the CIA to put out that information. I think you alluded it to a little bit. And also that their actual intent to go to war was long before 9/11. It was formulated back in the early 90s. And both of you can comment on that. And one other thing I wanted to ask about, something you said, that there's no money going to Reconstruction, you can't even see any. I want to know what you think, where you think the money is going, and also you mentioned the larger imperial plans. Could you expound on that? Thank you.
Well, on Dick Cheney going to the CIA, it's fact, he did. But don't worry, the presidential commission that's been being put together to investigate the intelligence failures won't be allowed to investigate that, because that falls into, you know, the policy use of intelligence. So we'll never get to know if Dick Cheney had anything more than what he claims, which is just an interest in intelligence matters, as opposed to what everybody else says occurred, which is direct pressure on the analysts to come up with data which sustains the desire to go to war, a desire that Dick Cheney himself is one of the original architects of back when he was Secretary of Defense in 1992. This war with Iraq has been planned since 1992 by Dick Cheney, by Paul Wolfowitz, by Donald Rumsfeld, and by the others. It's part of an overall strategy known as the National Security Strategy of the United States of America, which was published in September of 2002, but written in 1992, rewritten in 1997. And an interesting thing about the original National Security Strategy policy, at least the one that came out in 97 as part of the Project for a New American Century, is that it talked about the need to impose America's unilateral will preemptively on areas of the world that we unilaterally determined to be of the national security interest. In the Middle East, Iraq was seen as the key element of getting a foothold in a region so we could affect regional transformation. But a little footnote was, you can't do this right now because the American people would never go for this. Now remember, this is Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Donald Rumsfeld writing this thought process. America will require a Pearl Harbor type event before we can implement this strategy. September 11th occurred. On September 12th, Paul Wolfowitz and Donald Rumsfeld were preaching war with Iraq to President Bush. And 1 year after the September 11th attacks, the National Security Strategy of the United States of America, which was originally drafted in 1992, rejected by Congress as un-American, reworked in 1997, was made the policy of the land.
I'll take those the last two questions. First of all, what's being done with the money? Well, the first thing to understand is that so far, most of the money being spent is Iraq's money. All right. The Iraq Development Fund, they took over Iraq's oil money from the Oil for Food program. They took over frozen Iraqi assets held in the United States since the invasion of Kuwait. And they took roughly $1 billion in cash that they found on their various raids in the invasion. And that's the money that's being spent so far. A lot of this $20 billion, which is really, there's not much more than $15 billion of it for reconstruction, hasn't kicked in yet, hasn't been disbursed. Of that money, a lot of it is being spent on, as you might expect, buying oil for Iraqis. Because, you know, they don't have very much. It's a country largely devoid of oil. And so you need to import oil, not just from Kuwait, but from Turkey. And interestingly enough, Halliburton, which has been importing refined oil for Iraqis, it imports it from Kuwait, which is a oil producer, the third largest reserves in the world, for $2.27 a gallon, and imports it from Turkey, which is not an oil producer, for $1.07 a gallon. Now, don't ask me to explain to you how this works, and don't ask anyone to explain to Iraqis why they spend 2 to 6 hours in gas lines in Baghdad, in a country with the second largest oil reserves in the world. So that's one place where it's going. Another place it's going is Halliburton, directly, through all kinds of ways. And these are corporations that don't prosper by providing goods that people want to buy. They prosper by cronyism, by getting military contracts on a cost-plus basis, so they don't have to keep costs down. They don't have to worry about actually doing what they contract to do, because they're guaranteed the contracts already, and they're getting the money. They are, in many places, they are literally sitting and not repairing the water and not repairing the electricity like they're supposed to, and not allowing Iraqis who know how to do it to actually do the job. That's what a lot of the money is being spent on. In terms of the larger imperial plans, well, part of it is this: there's a shift in the big structure of U.S. foreign policy that Scott was talking about. Okay, the Paul Wolfowitz is one of the big theorists of this, and in 92 he wrote the Defense Planning Guidance, which talked about not only making the United States a sort of overtly military empire as opposed to one which cloaked its imperial policies in a softer shield. They talked about very specifically alienating their allies, because one of the things they learned from the Gulf War is if you have allies, if you want to preserve this idea that you have international support for what you do, then sometimes you're constrained in what you do. And so Wolfowitz was very upset that we didn't go in, take over Baghdad, pave over Iraq, and make it some kind of neo-colonial paradise that he has fantasies about. And the reason was because we wanted to keep the international coalition behind us. We had a UN resolution and all of these things. So he said, screw all of that. Forget about international institutions. Forget about our own allies. In the future, we want to talk to them strictly in terms of power relations. We're on top, so you have to do what we say. That's a large-scale realignment that they wanted to do in 92, and they've been doing only since Bush got into office. But also, there's a long-term continuing interest in controlling the oil of the Middle East. It's been a keystone of U.S. foreign policy ever since World War II. It's not about we need the oil, right? It's not that we didn't go to Iraq because we need their oil, like a lot of people say, because you know what? They sold it to us. In fact, before the war, the United States was the largest consumer of Iraqi oil. Big surprise. Take most countries in the world, we're the largest consumer of the oil they produce, right? We consume half of all of Angola's oil production, for example. It's not that we needed the oil. We could get that by buying it the way everyone else does. But the United States has always wanted to exert political force in the region and in the world by controlling the heart of the world's oil reserves, which is two-thirds of them are in the Middle East. We've had a great deal of control and leverage over Saudi Arabia for a long time, which continues up to this day, but which many people, neoconservatives think is getting very unstable, and they're very worried about the future. At the same time, they think of controlling Iraq as better in several ways. One is that its oil is less tapped. It may have almost as much oil as Saudi Arabia, but it is the least developed major oil source in the world. In Texas, there are 1 million oil wells that have been drilled since oil was discovered. In Iraq, there's 2,000 oil wells. It's very, very unexplored. It's also much better situated for projection of force into the rest of the region. Saudi Arabia is kind of a little bit out of it, but once you have your troops in Iraq, you can instantly, like this, exert pressure on Syria, exert pressure on Iran. And Syria was acting up a little bit after the war, so one day the United States turned off the spigot on the Iraqi pipeline that leads through Syria, and the next day Syria was back capitulating to whatever the United States wanted. It's an extreme source of easy political leverage over all of these other countries. So that kind of power is the heart of it. It's not just power over those countries, but power over those countries translates to power over everyone. Japan and China depend on Middle East oil. China is now a heavy importer of Middle East oil. If the United States controls the spigot, it always has veto power over any large-scale policy of Japan and China. It controls the spigot to Europe. It also has, it has continued, even as it's just in your face telling Europe to go to hell, it's continued in its domination over them because very often they feel the United States has a knife at their jugular. And so that's the larger policy. It's just breaking apart because they are not controlling Iraq the way they had planned to.
My name's Bill Shortell. I'm from West Hartford. Since the government obviously knew there were no weapons of mass destruction, why have they spent $900 million scouring the countryside for it, and why didn't they just plant some and invent them?
Weapons of mass destruction aren't created by magic, and every one of them has a unique signature. I mentioned crime scene investigator and the forensic investigations. We know the genetic genotyping of all of Iraq's biological agent. So in order to plant biological agent in Iraq, you would have to derive it from the original Iraqi stocks, which have been destroyed. You can't just simply grow it in Kansas, bring it to Iraq and plant it. That would never survive any forensic investigation. The same holds true with chemical agent. Once you take a chemical agent and you have it, you can break it down and basically tell not only what its different components were, but where they came from, what lot they were manufactured in, what chemical processes were involved. So again, it's not as easy as just planting it. The other thing is, who would plant it? American military forces? Now, a lot of derision, you know, a lot of derisive comments about the military, but I'll tell you this. Military officers and the men and women who wear the uniform of the United States of America are honorable people. And they're just not going to sit there and stand by idly. You might get one or two to play the game, but the kind of planting you talk about requires a wholesale corruption of a system that has as its core value integrity and honor. That isn't going to happen, and I'm thankful. Now, I'm concerned about some aspects of the civilian side of the military. That's where ideology trumps, you know, basic honor and integrity. And I'm very concerned about some of the things that are coming out of Iraq. 8 biologists continue to be held incommunicado by the United States, charged with nothing, no evidence of biological weapons, but these are the brain trust of Iraqi biological activity. Donald Rumsfeld has made several statements that disturb me, such as if Saddam can hide in a hole, so can biological agent. that there might be thousands of holes in Iraq that could contain biological agent. Just the other day, Donald Rumsfeld said that one of his big concerns is that there's still biological weapons in Iraq, not massive production facilities, but seed stock. And then you have reports coming out of Baghdad of an Iraqi biologist named Hindawi, who is now working with the United States, who perfected the Iraqi research into dry powdered anthrax. They never produced it, and he admitted this. But now, according to some sources, he's running a laboratory in Abu Ghraib producing dry powdered anthrax using Iraqi biological seed stock, so that if it is planted and this forensic investigation is done, it would point to an Iraqi source. I'm very concerned that Donald Rumsfeld, in an effort to preserve not only his reputation, but to preserve the reputation of the president and the Bush administration to provide justification for the war, would consider planting weapons of mass destruction. This is why it's imperative that two things happen. One, from this moment on, we never accept any finding of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that comes from a purely American source. That we must get United Nations inspectors back to Iraq. They must take over this investigation, because if there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, I want to find them, I want to destroy them, I want to disarm Iraq. But I don't trust Rumsfeld. I don't trust Bush. I trust the United Nations.
In fact, you know, one of the most naked impositions of sort of imperial arrogance, perhaps even more so than the war itself, was the fact that the United States deliberately violated Security Council Resolution 1441, which it itself had pushed through the Security Council after the war. The weapons inspector's mission was not done. They had not certified Iraq free of weapons of mass destruction, but the United States terminated all the UN weapons inspections, replaced them with US weapons inspectors in direct violation of their own resolution that they had passed. I just want to say two things about this, though. One is, we must understand the United States would not have gone to war unless they knew Iraq didn't have any functional weapons of mass destruction. They went to war against Iraq because it could not fight back, because it couldn't inflict unacceptable casualties. They didn't go to war against North Korea because North Korea has made it very clear that they will fight back. And the other thing we must understand is that we went to war in the way we did against Iraq. We could not have done it unless they had known Iraq has no connection with Al-Qaeda. Imagine this. For 1 year, they're posturing about a war and leading up to it and talking about it, making it clear to everyone that a war is going to happen, and doing nothing else. Saddam Hussein, in the days before the invasion, in the hours before the invasion, withdrew $1 billion from the Central Bank of Iraq. Imagine, give him a year in which he could withdraw $1 billion and turn it over to Al-Qaeda, whose total funding in the world is something on the order of a few hundred million dollars. Had they thought there was any chance Saddam would give either weapons or money to Al-Qaeda, they never would have talked about war for a whole year before going. They either would have said, we're not going to war, or they would have done it immediately by surprise. They knew there was no connection. They couldn't have done what they did if they hadn't known that.
I'm willing to accept everything you guys have said, 100%. Everything was wrong. We did everything wrong. The soldiers are kicking the Quran on the ground, killing people, letting them die. Everything, 100%. Let's forget all that. I want to know what each of you guys would do when the civil war starts. I mean, we got the Kurds being bombed the other day, got the cleric being retaliated against today. Tomorrow, the Sunnis. Back and forth. Civil war is probably going to start within the next few weeks. Tens of thousands of troops are going to die. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqians. Forget everything. No politics. You have control. You're Paul Bremer. Starting tomorrow, what's the three things you would do to put an end to this, put an end to the civil war, fix Iraq, and get the troops home?
First of all, I reject your proposition that we're going to fix Iraq. We're not going to fix Iraq. The solution is simple. It's get the troops home and then let the Iraqis sort it out. It's not my problem. If you think you can fix it, you're just going to stay there and get stuck and bogged down in the mire. We can't fix it.
So let
only
them.
The Iraqis can fix it.
Okay, thanks. So your answer is let them fight it out. Let us run. Let them fight their civil war out. Whoever comes out on top, we deal with it. Your answer?
That's not my answer. But let me tell you this. I agree completely with Scott. You must understand, the United States didn't go there to fix Iraq.
I just want to know what you do tomorrow.
Let me answer your question, okay? You have to start with the understanding, if you believe anything I said, they're not fixing what they could easily fix. All this talk about, you know, some people are saying, oh, well, look at the German occupation. We couldn't rebuild electricity in Germany for years. I told you already, Saddam, with no resources, rebuilt far more than the United States has rebuilt in Iraq now. We're not there to fix the country. We're not there to create an independent government there. We're there to serve our own purposes, which I've talked about. And in the pursuit of serving those purposes, we are exacerbating tensions. We are creating more sectarian strife than there was before. We are turning more people, we're sharpening the Arab-Kurd divide and the Sunni-Shia divide dramatically more than it was before. All right, simply by our presence there and by what we're doing. And these kinds of attacks, like the one in Erbil on the KDP and PUK, would not have happened if the United States wasn't there. So the United States is... basically, everything they're doing in Iraq is wrong, and so they should leave, and yet there's this problem that if they leave overnight and there's no replacement, there's no force to keep security, that it's likely, very likely, no one can say with certainty that mass violence will break out. They have deliberately put Iraq in a catch-22. You remove the government, you don't put anything in its place, and then you say, look, you need us, and that's all there is to it. We're going to keep on screwing you and make everything worse, but it's a catch-22. Neither way out works. And I have to say this, that it's a bad situation. There is no perfect solution, but the best solution in a very bad situation is this. Start pulling the U.S. out now. Replace them with an independent UN peacekeeping force that has no component from the United States. I don't believe the United States can be part of a UN force without controlling it. No participation from Britain, no participation from Australia and Poland, the other two belligerents. A UN peacekeeping force that is not the government of Iraq, that does not make policy, does not privatize Iraqi companies, does not change Iraqi laws. Bremer, with the stroke of one pen, decided Iraq would have a flat tax, 15%. Just imagine Bremer in charge of the United States. Well, you don't have to think too hard to imagine that, do you? Okay, that won't change any of those things. It doesn't have a mandate to privatize Iraq's oil, but is just there to keep the peace while the Iraqis, by themselves and under their own process, generate a political process just with the possibilities of extreme violence sort of kept out of the picture. That's what we need. We need to start pulling U.S. troops out tomorrow, and we need to have a Security Council resolution which says the U.S. is out, which says a U.N. peacekeeping force is in, and which, I will add this, the United States has inflicted huge amounts of damage on Iraq illegally, in violation of the law, in violation of the Geneva Convention, and so we need to pay for the reconstruction. We don't need to be there to do it, but we need to pay for it.
So your answer is replace American troops with the UN immediately, sir, and declare martial law?
And stop declare the martial law?
Sir, if you could...
UN peacekeeping forces, yes.
Good question, but we got to move on and get the heat down on this building to save the taxpayers some money.
I have no like for George W. Bush. I don't want anyone to think that, as Jonathan can testify to.
Jason.
My question is about weapons of mass destruction, and particularly nuclear weapons, because a country can have biological weapons or chemical weapons. That's bad, and it can kill people, but that can't really destroy whole cities on the kind of level we're talking about. Certain countries now are developing nuclear weapons. The reason I supported the Iraqi war, and I think actually unfortunately now, but the reason I supported it is the idea of Saddam Hussein with a nuclear weapon was terrifying to me. He wasn't anywhere near close. I shouldn't have believed that he was close. But Iran and North Korea are... I think North Korea has it. Iran is this close. An Iranian nuclear bomb is a scary thought to me. And, you know, we say, well, get the U.S. out, get this out, you know, UN everything. What way would you deal with an Iranian nuclear threat or a North Korean nuclear threat? You know, I think that, you know, a lot of countries were afraid of what we did in Iraq. They think we're, like, nuts and therefore giving up their weapons programs out of sheer fear. Libya did that. Libya never would have given up its weapons programs had we not attacked. Even the crazy guy swinging the drunken beer bottle, as much as that's not a real foreign policy, has been having some positive residual effects, I think. So what would be your way of dealing with nuclear countries getting weapons of mass destruction?
First of all, Libya capitulated to the United States not because of the Iraq War. Libya has been squeezed under sanctions ever since the late 1980s. All right? For at least 5 years now, Gaddafi has been desperately trying to make any kind of contacts, make any kind of rapprochement with the United States. He's been fended off until recently. This was a slam dunk. All they had to do was start talking to Gaddafi, and they could accomplish all of this. It didn't have to have anything to do with the war in Iraq. Second of all, what are we going to do if North Korea gets nuclear weapons? Well, I don't know. You know, here we are just sitting along, essentially defenseless, except for, 6,000 thermonuclear warheads on intercontinental ballistic missiles. Gee, I wonder what we would do if North Korea got a nuclear weapon. Oh, my God, how scary that could be. George W. Bush, not long ago, in this fall said, and I quote, "Free nations do not produce weapons of mass destruction." An interesting view of history, but has very little connection with reality. I'll tell you, the only country right now that is developing a doctrine of using nuclear weapons, a first-use doctrine for use in wars that are totally and completely voluntary, that the United States just wants to do as part of its imperial plans, is the United States. They're creating a whole generation of nuclear weapons. They're funding a generation of nuclear weapons, which with the entire design is to make the use of nuclear weapons politically okay, politically acceptable. I think that's absolutely absurd and ridiculous. And to think about a greater threat from North Korea or Iran, or say, what if Pakistan got a nuclear bomb? Well, they got one. Oh, gee, they haven't attacked us yet. How odd. Perhaps they don't want to be annihilated. You know, it's not such a big deal. And in fact, in a world in which you have countries like the United States, which are throwing their weight around and invading other countries with this gigantic arsenal, there's some case to be made. I'm not going to make the case. But you could imagine a case to be made for saying that if everyone had them, things would be a little bit easier. Now, Gaddafi actually called for this. Gaddafi said, "I propose that conventional armaments be eliminated and replaced with cheap nuclear bombs to be made accessible to everyone." This was back in the 70s.
I am somebody who believes that if you have a weapon, eventually you're going to want to use that weapon. So the only way to eliminate the threat of nuclear weapons is to get rid of all nuclear weapons, including the ones here in the United States. Now, how do you go about getting rid of nuclear weapons? I'll tell you how you don't do it. You don't do it by pretending to embrace the concept of disarmament, as we did in Iraq, get rid of weapons, starve a nation of its ability to defend itself, and then invade it in violation of international law. That's not how you get rid of nuclear weapons, because all we've done is send a clear signal to the North Koreans and the Iranians that the only way you stop an American invasion is to acquire a nuclear weapon. So now we've made the world that much more dangerous. You get rid of nuclear weapons by disarmament that's founded in on the fundamentals of international law, negotiated treaties that are multilateral in nature and binding, treaties that the United States will adhere to as an equal partner, equal under the law. And yet we have the Bush administration, which has policies that are the antithesis of disarmament. We've walked out of treaties. We have sat in Geneva and told our European allies, in the case of the Biological Weapons Convention, that there is a double standard. It applies to you, not to us. That's not how you do it. My recommendation is sound disarmament, founded on the principles of total nonproliferation, meaning getting rid of all nuclear weapons, all biological weapons, all chemical weapons. There cannot be a double standard. And America doesn't have to fear the rest of the world if we head down that path, because we have unmatched conventional military strength and we have unmatched economic strength that we'll be able to leverage into imposing our will on people anyways. So why do we need to have nuclear weapons? Nuclear weapons will only result in radioactive slag heaps, whether here in the United States or elsewhere. That's not the future I want for my kids.
You can ruin your whole day.
We're going to just take a couple more, okay. And then hopefully speakers will be able to stay after and talk to people.
I'll try to make it brief.
Thanks.
All right. My name is Daniel. I'm a student, and I want to thank you both for great speeches tonight. My question is, we all seem to acknowledge that the Bush presidency is actually more of a criminal regime. Both of you in your answers to questions have said these are men that would do anything to get their power. Mr. Ritter, one thing you just alluded to was the Project for the New American Century, Rebuilding America's Defenses, which they put out. And they said that a new galvanizing event on the scale of Pearl Harbor was needed to galvanize the American people behind another perpetual war. One thing that we're finding out, not through the American press, but through the foreign media, are some interesting facts, like how five of the hijackers trained at secure U.S. Air Force bases. And for example, U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Steve Butler has said after 25 years in the military, he's willing to testify that he trained Muhammad Atta in Monterey. He has been gag ordered and suspended from the Air Force base. We have people blowing the whistle at the NSA, FBI, and CIA, saying that this attack was allowed to happen and that we had intelligence that should have at least prevented this attack. Now, if this is a regime that's willing to do anything, I've got a three-part question. First of all, when are people on the left and the right going to drop this farce that 9/11 and the official story adds up when we know it doesn't, and there's evidence, and we can pretend like it doesn't? When are we going to first acknowledge the truth of 9/11? Secondly, when are we going to realize that our republic is actually under threat, and that they've got electronic voting machines in all the states right now, that they're redistricting all the states right now, that the Patriot Act 1 and 2 are attacking our fundamental rights, that this is not just Nixonian secrecy, but our very republic is going right into fascism right now. We are Germany 1937. When are we going to stop the jokes and stop this soft activism and get real about this, get militant and begin to fight? A People's Commission won't do it. When are we going to start speaking out and be realistic? That's my question.
I think if one theme permeated my presentation tonight, it was the concept of citizenship. And the necessity of each American citizen to take possession of this country. You do that by recognizing that we are the government, they aren't the government. September 11th, you know, we won't know what happened until the facts are on the table. The facts aren't in. I guarantee you this right now. No one in this room knows what happened. You think you know, but there are documents that the Bush administration have not released to the commission. You don't know what are in those documents, and you won't know until they are released, the facts are put on the table, and we know. So demand that these documents are prepared. Look, there's one document that people have alluded to, and it's a presidential daily intelligence briefing in August that says the president knew Al-Qaeda named, the document named hijackers, said they were going to take airplanes and fly them into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. People said this document exists. Put it on the table. Why are we mute on this? Are you calling your congressmen? Are you calling your senators? Are you boycotting them? Are you doing what you can? Then get other people to do it as well. Take control of those whom you elect to higher office. You have to. If you don't, and you just sit here and speak, speech is nice. Actions always are louder than words. Take actions, hold your representatives accountable.
Out of all the things that has happened since 9/11, or actually before 9/11, but we just found out about it afterwards, the thing that surprised me most is the deal with these electronic voting machines. It's stunning. When you're at the point where this is the basic infrastructure of democracy, it's been privatized for absolutely no reason, to a bunch of corporations which are heavily Republican, which make sure that their own counting algorithm, they claim their counting algorithm is proprietary information. And so they are counting our votes for our elections, and they say the government and the people don't have a right to know how they're counting our votes. This is astonishing. This is astonishing even for this administration. You remember 58,000 people disenfranchised in Florida in 2000? It's good that problem was solved, right? Except that in 2002, they disenfranchised 92,000 people. And there was almost no whimper about it.
You were listening to a town hall on a rock that took place on February 5th in West Hartford, Connecticut. You can contact the program at unwelcomeguests.org and download an MP3 of this talk, which we encourage you to share with others. Thanks for listening.
will.